This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the AIPIS show for accredited income property investment specialists and those who aspire to be. If you're a real estate, mortgage, or financial professional, this is the place for you. We'll explore innovative investment analysis, sales, marketing, and income-generating strategies for the most historically proven wealth creator, income property. Learn from the experts as they show you how to build a better business and a better life.
Welcome to the AIPIS show for accredited income property investment specialists and those who desire to be. This is your host, Jason Hartman, where we talk about increasing your income, your productivity, and just generally having a better life while serving your clients better with America's most historically proven asset class, income property. We have a great interview for you today, and we will be back with that in less than 60 seconds. Hey, it's my pleasure to welcome David Wood. He is a fascinating guy who's done a lot of stuff in his life. Real estate investor in three different aspects of real estate, which you'll hear about. A big time traveler. He traveled around the world and backpacked for about 10 and a half years. Lived, worked, and traveled to over 50 countries. And he's a fascinating guy. You're really just going to enjoy this interview as we talk about the three different strategies for real estate investors, and then we'll find out which one he likes the best. David, welcome. How are you?
Hey, Jason. It's so good to hear your voice. I feel like we're developing this friendship through the ether. I love it.
Yeah, we are. We are. It's a virtual friendship. Now, I should also mention to the listeners, you're coming to us from beautiful Vancouver, Canada, right?
Well, Kelowna. I'm about 4 hours. I'm in the interior, so I'm peeking. I'm looking at a lake that's 80 miles long from my window right now, so right in the interior.
Good stuff. Well, so, you know, you've got a fascinating history. You've done all kinds of great entrepreneurial ventures, a lot of real estate investing. And you were saying to me, we talked for just a moment before we started recording for the show, and you were talking about the three main real estate investing strategies. And then you told me which one you like best. Now, many people would say, you know, there's like only one strategy, or there's two, flip or hold. Some would say, you know, there's 100 different strategies for real estate investing, but you kind of boiled it down to three, which I thought was interesting the way you put that. And can you share that with the listeners?
Yeah, sure. You know, I mean, and just to sort of give background, I own a lot of real estate, and I remember the first investment property that I bought, which was a little tiny 2-bedroom house on the north end of our city here. And you know, we didn't have a lot of money at the time, but we set a goal to own $10 million of real estate. We called our company Decca Enterprises, and me and my buddy, who's a chiropractor, and I, we just said, let's start a little side business in real estate investing. I just remember that first purchase, and right then we were completely sort of ignorant to the whole idea of real estate, and we've evolved into all different realms, all commercial and small family homes, and all different kinds of mobile home parks, you know, all different kinds of philosophies.
But now explain who we is when you say we've evolved.
My business partner and I, he's a chiropractor in town here, and we just decided as two friends to buy real estate together. And so, you know, our real estate portfolio started as a dream that we were going to amass $10 million worth of real estate. And we have way, way, way beyond that now, probably four times that now. And so, you know, but it started off with us. We had $6,000, $3,000 each was our original deposit on a little house. And we, you know, we got a renter and we started. I mean, the most important thing is we started. And the three strategies that has evolved. I didn't have this strategy when I started. It's evolved through experience. Is one, you know, to buy real estate and sell at an appropriate time, right? In other words, that there is some real estate that we sold, and I'll explain why.
So the interesting thing is you don't call that flipping. I want to make that distinction. Right.
Yeah, no, there's a difference. There's a much, for me, is a big difference, and I'll explain it. And then there's buying and flipping. In other words, I've done that, and I like executive flips. So I've done that where I made $500,000 in a year and a half. By buying
an executive flip means an expensive home.
Well, it really wasn't. I mean, here's what it is. I paid $247,000 for the home. I bought the ugliest house on the most beautiful street, which is a real great strategy. I put I had $200,000 in cash, so I didn't borrow money to do the rentals. And in Canada, where I live, you know, there are no capital gains if you live in the property for a year or more. So there was no point flipping for the year. So the idea was I'd go in, I'd spend the year and do the reno. And it actually took me a little longer than that. I didn't do the work myself. I brought in people, but I was the main contractor. So I was around there, and you know, we sort of did a beautiful job in bringing the house to look like the street. The street was an old, gorgeous street. It's called Maple Street. It's two lines of maple trees. And so we were very careful to sort of bring it back into character, which took a little extra work. But the $200,000, so I had $447,000 into it. I put a little tiny sign on my garden. I didn't go through a realtor. I put a little tiny sign on my garden grass when I put it up for sale. And the first person came in and bought it. He paid $945,000 or something like that. It wasn't quite $947,000. So we made about $500,000 on that. And because we lived in it, or I lived in it for a year, there was no capital gains on that money. So that was that's an executive flip for me, or a flip. And now I know that I watch the home and garden shows, and I see these people go in there and tear something up in a month and flip it. And I actually feel I could make a lot of money doing that, because I think I've got a good eye. And, you know, but it's that discipline of doing the right renovations at the right amount of money, and only doing the things that really will give you a great return. So the buy flip scenario is not something I've done it, but I like executive. I have a property right now that I could make $1 million on, where I put in money, but you know, that's a high end again. You know, I mean, we bought the property for 1.5, and I put in about 400,000. Again, you see the money, but I could probably, my banker just came over the other day and says, you know, you could probably get 3.5 for this right now, the way it sits. So that could be an executive flip. I'm not interested in flipping this one, but if I wanted to, for me, if I've got more of a bankroll, which I do, I prefer the high end flips, because I think that, you know, the people who are going to buy $1 million or $2 million house or $3 million home often lack vision. They have money, but they lack the vision of, and
they kind of lack a lot of time to think about it too sometimes.
Yeah.
You know?
And so sometimes if you could create that vision for them, and typically for me, it's buying the right street or the right view. And so, you know, if you've got the right view, the right street, and again, thinking about
I have a lot of friends who've made tons of money in the uber high end, you know, Newport Coast, California, Palm Springs, really just incredibly high end homes. But that's pretty risky stuff. I mean,
it is.
It is. So I don't want to go too much into that for purposes of this show. But
here's the difference. The difference with the risk is if you're buying something you could live in. So in other words, for example, both examples I gave you would be something where I could, like the other home, if it hadn't sold, I could just live in this beautiful home, right? So in other words, that's a different mindset. It's a very different game, and it's not one I recommend, but it's one that I have the tolerance for and the touch for, right?
Well, see, so that's an interesting point. I want to speak to that for a moment. See, what happens as a real estate investor is that, you know, over time, you're going to work up to taking bigger risk, bigger problems. You know, you're going to have the cushion in there in your financial life to be able to absorb, you know, some bigger risk that could have some bigger returns. But, you know, when you're starting out, you got to be careful. Yeah.
And you have the bankroll. If you're borrowing money.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah. Of course, I said resources.
Sure, because if you're borrowing the money to do the reno, and then the risk is much more. I mean, it's just a lot, right? So we talked about, you know, the buy, sell at the right time, buy and flip. And I say my preference is that, or buy and hold. And the buy and hold is, to me, is you know, if you buy right, and you know, you have a positive cash flow real estate is really the most. People talk about buying cash flow real estate, but they don't think about the positive cash flow real estate.
What does that mean?
Well, it just means that at the end of the month, there's positive.
I mean, I know what you mean, but I'm just
I know you know. But for someone listening out, you know, I watched a lot of people get seduced, and a lot of newbies newbies, a lot of virgins in this market get seduced when the rush is on. So when the gold rush starts. And so when you talk just before 2008, when the prices seem to just be going up and up and up and up, and people will...
Well, really, you're looking at 2004 and 2005.
Yeah.
That's really the time.
Yeah. And people were jumping in and they were saying, look, you know, and they were betting on the increase of the value of the property. And that's where the big risk, and I think is that risk is not worth it. I would never, ever buy something. Betting, you know, it's like you might as well just go down to Vegas and take some money and throw it down on a roulette wheel.
That is a fool's game.
It is. And it's just, it's a crazy game. And it's emotionally, and I've watched so many of my friends who were not financially able, school teachers, and, you know, and they were saying, I want to get in because everyone's talking about this thing is just going up and up and up and up. And then they got in, and of course the prices came down, and now the mortgage payments don't cover the cost of their mortgage, and the renters aren't covering any cost, and they can't get out of it because the values drop so greatly. And so that's the fool's game. So I think, you know, first of all, I'd say, you know, don't jump in when everyone else is jumping in. That is not a time for you to say, I'm going to suddenly become a real estate investor. And that's what I love about what you do, Jason, is teaching people that in any economy, truly in any economy, we can make this work. And the math is pretty simple, right? To have positive cash flow real estate. And when it's positive, and Jason, I don't know what margins you work on, but I'm fascinated to hear. But, you know, when we buy right, and we understand at the end of the month that even if our place has to sit empty, which often they don't, but let's say they sit empty for a few months, that we're not suddenly in this cash crunch. And now that we're panicking, we want to be buying real estate. And it wants to be something that we almost have to remind ourselves to think about sometimes because it's just easy. And I think there is an easy way and an elegant way.
Yeah, that's great. That's a good way to put it. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it we have to remind ourselves to think about it because it's easy. Hopefully, we get to that point. That's good.
Well, you know what? You know what I mean by that? That you're not under the pressure of, oh crap, I've got to come up with an extra $200, or oh crap, the roof broke, or the roof started leaking, and now I need to find this extra few thousand dollars to pay for it. You know, and often with our real estate portfolio, you know, each property will have its own economy, you know, so a property will have, because, you know, if you're buying real estate for a long-term vision of having complete financial freedom, then, you know, then the money coming in isn't money you should be spending, you know, unless you're saying I'm jumping in. If you're jumping in and you need that extra few hundred dollars or $500 or $1,000 you can make, and you need that right away, you know, it's a different energy. But if you can leave that in its own bank account to manage itself, and then over time, as you amass, you know, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, if you want to pull some out for something else or buy something else. And that's what we tend to do. We tend to not use the money. And it just makes life very, very easy. And it gives us this long-term vision of creating a very, very large portfolio of great positive cash flow real estate.
Okay, so David, those are all great points. Let's drill down on maybe a couple of them. So first of all, I am very much anti-speculation, even though I have done that many times and I have made money. And, you know, a few of them, it's not that I really lost money per se, but I was forced to hold on much longer than I was thinking I would have to, right? And
that's more normal than abnormal,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
so
yeah,
you experience what the normal
right,
is, right?
Yeah. And so, you know, my commandment number 5 of my 10 commandments of successful investing is the property must make sense the day you buy it or you don't buy it. Well, really the commandment is thou shalt not gamble, okay? So no speculation, no gambling. And here's how you know if it's an investment. You know, people throw around the word investment. Oh, I'm an investor. I make investments. But they're really just gamblers and speculators, as you were hearkening to that point a few moments ago. And here's how you know if something's an investment, in my opinion. Does it produce income? If it doesn't produce income, it's a speculation. If it produces income, it could be a good investment, or at least it can be considered an investment. Okay, but if it's vacant land, if it's, you know, super high priced real estate that has
I did that one. Yeah. Sorry interrupting. I did that one. Yeah. The vacant land thing. That was just a suck.
It's gambling.
As far it sucks money out of your pocket. Yeah, really.
No, good point. If it doesn't produce income, it's not an investment. It's a speculation. So all these people that are into precious metals, non-dividend paying stocks, real estate that makes no sense. In other words, it has a terrible rent to value ratio and you're going to have huge negative cash flows. You know, none of that produces income. So that does not qualify as an investment. It is a speculation. And so don't call yourself an investor. Call yourself a speculator. It's okay to be a speculator if you got enough money to do it and you've got the risk tolerance, but you're not an investor, okay? I mean, it just drives me crazy.
Well, again, there is a way to speculate. If you want to speculate, I mean, imagine in a small family home, I got a friend who's painting, a guy, and he's become a friend, who's painting my house right now. And he wants to get into the market. And I said to him, look, and he doesn't have a lot of cash, but he wants to buy himself a home. And I said, well, you know, there's another way for you to think long term is, you know, when you're starting out, you can buy a home for you and your wife. And as long as she has the tolerance to understand that you're going to go into something that's a little less expensive, you're going to do some important renovations, which would be, you know, probably the kitchen and the bathroom and the master bedroom or something, you know, a few areas that are really important to women. And then after the, you know, you get through the first year and a half or year when you're no longer capital gains exempt, if you wanted to put it on the market and you want to start growing a portfolio with no money. I said, but if the market changes, you have this beautiful little house you can live in. That would be if I was a speculator and I didn't have a lot of money. That way, you know, you've got a double bet. You know, it's like having a braces, or what do you call them? A belt and braces on, right? A suspenders on, where you know that if you want to speculate, but at the end of the day, if he doesn't, you're just going to live in that little house and love living there and not be worried about it. I mean, that is a different philosophy than what a lot of people do.
Well,
right?
That's a good point. And I have done speculations that way, where I will buy a home that I want to live in and live there. And then, you know, I'll get lucky because it's just luck. I didn't know it was going to happen. I've never met anybody, David, who can reliably predict appreciation. Okay. I mean, a lot of people make predictions, but are they reliable? They've all got holes in that ship. Okay. Sometimes they're right, but a lot of times they're wrong. And, you know, it's a fool's game, as we say. But, you know, if you live in the house and you can afford the house and you need a place to live anyway, that's not so bad. Although, I would actually argue that if it's a high-end property, you do much better off just renting the high-end property and buying a lot of low-end properties you rent.
By the way, I agree with you. I use the example of my painter who doesn't have a lot of money saying he'd like to get into a real estate market. And I said, well, the only way I would speculate is to buy something that I would love to live in long term, make the renovations, put it on the market. And the market's doing well for you and you can sell it and you make a little bit of money. You can continue that as long, again, as your partner is able to live and understand a construction zone that will continue going on for, you know, two or three flips before you end up, you know, creating your bankroll. That's just one idea. But let me ask you a question, because, I mean, when I look back and I look back on, you know, when I the one example I gave of buy and sell at the right time, I have a couple of examples of that. And one would be where when we first started out, we bought this, you know, I told you we bought this little house on the North End and, you know, and we weren't at the positive cash flow part of it wasn't something we understood. We just wanted to get into real estate. We didn't really think about, you know, how much money we needed to
have. That's the way most people start. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And we didn't know that we had to have money left over and that when things happen, like, you know, the gutter broke or the central heating broke or something happened, that we needed extra money. So having a couple of $100 positive cash flow sometimes wasn't enough when we think about the needs of the house over 12 months or over the next 2 years. So we started to learn that, you know, making better choices in purchasing and making sure that that positive part was really positive and not just, you know, marginal. And so what we realized when George Bush borrowed, I think it was 80 or 8 billion, I think, I can't remember, it was a large number to pay down national debt, we started to have this heebie-jeebie feeling and about what was going on in real estate. And we actually made a decision. We said, you know what? Anything in our portfolio that's marginal, that has proven itself to be, you know, it's kind of scraping by and it's limping along and it's not, you know, we can see that it's not one of those great pieces that you have that just has this positive cash flow. It's easy to rent. You know, it's sound. You know, it's not, you know, it's not about to fall off the edge of a cliff because of, you know, erosion or anything like that. But we actually looked at some of our real estate that was marginal, and it was like on the very, very knife edge of positive cash flow. And we said, let's get out of all the stuff that now we've matured a little bit. Let's get out of that stuff because we understand it differently. And we wouldn't buy this. If we had to do it again, we wouldn't buy this particular property. And that's when we sold. And we sold out when the market was starting to move. So we made some money, and we took that money and we bought things that had better returns for us. And that's kind of how we did it, Jason.
Yeah, interesting. So one distinction I want to make on this concept of positive cash flow, I think that can be somewhat deceiving. Because, of course, someone could have a lot of equity in the property, and it's like you better have positive cash flow with all that equity sitting there doing nothing for you, okay? So that's one distinction I want to make. But the other distinction is I want to take everybody back to the crazy times that we mentioned 10 years ago. It's 2005 or even 2004. Everybody's going crazy. The market is frothy. We're in bubble territory, although it's... many people have a hard time seeing that, you know, at some points. And I predicted that a few years before it happened, that really the end of 2005 would be a bubble. Because in the U.S., the 3-1 ARMs, there were so many the adjustable rate mortgages that were going to adjust 3 years after. So if you just forward 2002 to 2005, you just knew all these adjustments were going to hit. Now, I predicted that really well, the real estate market side. But what I didn't know that made it much worse than I thought it would be is I didn't know about the Wall Street side. I didn't know about all of the new acronyms we learned. And we learned about what Wall Street was doing with their securitized mortgages and selling the same pool of loans 33 times and all of the disgusting stuff they were doing. So that I did not know about, and I couldn't have predicted. But the mortgage adjustment thing made me know, other than the fact that prices were going crazy and everybody was heady, that we were in for a bubble. But here's the interesting part, is that back then, you know, the lending was so irresponsible that you could be one day out of prison and you could buy, you know, 50 properties with no money down or maybe 5% down, right? It was absurd how liberal the lending was, right? But one of the interesting things that happened, if you were to be responsible, is you could do something that I dubbed the deferred down payment. Now, granted, this doesn't work for most people because they're not responsible. Okay, let's just set that out at the start. But the deferred down payment actually as a strategy is okay, in the sense that if you don't put any money into the property, I did an analysis on this that was pretty good. If you don't put any money into the property and you pay a negative cash flow, yes, I did say negative cash flow, as though I'm actually recommending that. Okay, I'm not crazy. Don't think I'm nuts here. Just bear with me. But if that negative cash flow is, say, $150 per month, versus putting 20 grand down, now I don't have the spreadsheet in front of me, so I can't remember the math exactly, but it basically showed that it would take you 9 years to recover the $20,000 you would have put down on the little single-family home, versus just paying the down payment on a deferred basis every month. And that didn't include any rent increases. So actually, to gain more leverage and control more with less, it really truly was better to do the deferred down payment plan. Now, the caveat is most people will forget about that plan after they do it, spend all their money, have no money in the bank to support the property, and totally screw it up. I get that. But I'm just saying from a purely...
No, but that's a discipline. I mean, what we're talking about here is with discipline. Yeah. Everything about real estate investing, there's disciplines that have to, you know, and you know, after summer comes fall, after fall comes winter, after winter comes spring, and a property's like that, you know, and there things happen, and if you don't have certain disciplines, the property can end up biting you in the ass, right? And they often do. So, but I mean, I think for as far as me, real estate is my home. I love real estate. I love real estate investing. It's become a real passion, and we know we don't do it to the extent in essence or the clarity of that you we do it because we love it, and we, you know, it's not our primary business, but you know, again, we have a lot of real estate. I do want to talk about something, Jason, that I don't know if a lot of people think about. One of the things that's made us a lot of money is negotiating the real estate deal, and I think I'm really, really strong in the area, and there's a few rules that I go by, and I wish I should write a template for it, and then maybe one day I'll share it with you, because I'm just going to do this off the top of my head. But I actually like to find for sale by owners, and I typically don't like talking to real estate agents when I'm negotiating. I always try and get around, and I always use a real estate agent to close. But as far as the negotiation part, I actually like to meet people. And so it doesn't matter what I'm buying, I will try and find a property. If I like a property, if I like a street, I don't mind knocking on doors. I don't mind, you know, I don't mind popping around the property in the evening if I see a real estate sign. So I don't try and cut the realtor out of the deal, but I do want to be face to face.
You want to have direct negotiation with
because
the seller.
I can find out what's really going on. And there's so many times, I mean, I've done this. I'll often negotiate price first, then I'll negotiate terms. So if I'm not ready to buy a property, right? And again, depending on what you're buying, so we buy a lot of big stuff as well. And sometimes I won't buy it for 6 months, but I have a deal in place. You know, if the market's expanding, and we've done that where there's been an increase in value, and so it's, you know, less of a mortgage that we've needed on the property. But often it's just a question of finding out what's really happening, you know. And if you can help the people, if they have a problem, if they're selling for a real reason, if they need to get out, if there's stuff they need and you can help them, quite often, you know, you can actually negotiate a really beautiful transaction where you can help them with something, and in return, you can get a much better deal. And because realtors end up, you know, they stay in.
Yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying. So let me ask you a question about that, though. You know, the realtors get in your way, they get in their own way a lot of times, and that's unfortunate. But what you're doing is a different kind of real estate than most, the vast majority of my listeners do. Okay, so I just wanted to have you make a distinction. You're doing a do-it-yourself plan. I mean, you're going out there and you're looking for deals and finding deals, and then you're doing some creative financing, it sounds like. And I want to ask you what kind of creative financing you're doing. You're not doing that's not the armchair investor strategy. I mean, that does take some time and work and effort to source those deals, right?
Sure. Well, I love the armchair strategy, by the way. I do both. I have armchair strategies that we utilize, and utilizing great proven, if you've got somebody who has a proven method and you trust that method, I mean, that really is a great way as well. So again, it's all about trust. It's all about proven track record. It's all about, you know, in that piece where you say, you know, I believe in this. So I do both. I just say that with me on that one, if I'm looking for something, and especially, you know, I think starting out, it's good to be guided, because it's easy to, they can be a minefield, and having someone with experience can help you through that, right?
Yeah, no question about it. Tell us about some of your creative financing. Like, how do you try to, you said, well, I said the word creative financing, you said terms. So you said you try to negotiate term or price first and then terms. What do you do on the terms? Let's hear about that.
Well, sometimes I'll say this. So I'll say, I'll use some real examples. So we bought this is a larger property. So again, it's a little bit outside this model, but it works the same. I've done it with smaller properties, but you know, where I've negotiated a price, and we've agreed on the price, and I don't try and mix them up. I don't ask for two things at once when I'm negotiating. I ask for the second one would be like, so, you know, and let's talk about closing dates. So we'd like to close in 6 months. And the person's already agreed to the price, and now they're so we had, for example, with this one property, which is a mobile home park with 44 units on a lake, we just said, look, you know, we'll close in 6 months. And the guy agreed to the price reduction and then the close. And then when we put the mortgage together, which was getting very, you know, the latter part of the 6 months, you know, that property was in, this was in 2003 or something like 2000. The property had increased quite considerably. I didn't do it for that reason. I just did it so that I can negotiate things and manage them in my time frame, because sometimes I'm not always ready to buy today. Sometimes I like doing it because it's a bit more fun. So they held the property at that price for 6 months, and then we bought it. So that would be price and then terms. And, you know, but I think there's often there could be a number of things to negotiate. And, but I just, when I negotiate one at a time. Let's get the price thing sorted out first. And I just think that sometimes, even when I watch the real estate shows, Jason, sometimes I think if you understand what someone's problem is, and if you understand that your job as someone who's buying is to help the person.
To solve their problem. Yeah.
Solve their problem.
That's how you get paid in life for anything. I mean, that's what we do for our customers. We solve their problems.
So let's say they turn around to you and they say, let's say it's a single mom and she has to sell because she's going through a divorce. And I bought a property like this, you know, and you say, well, listen, how can I help? And she says, well, you know, really what I need to sell right now, but I need to live in the house. And I can't move. I don't get my new place for 4 months or something like that. Or I'm moving across the country. Let's say it was a situation like that. You say, okay, so look, if I was able to help you today to do that, and then we let you stay in the home, and how can we do this? What would you be willing to do? And you ask them. It's not like you're going there and you say, well, I'll give you, you know, you don't have to be an ass about it. You just have to be kind. And I find kindness is one of the great methods of negotiation if you're really trying to help someone out. I'm not saying you can't lowball someone and in that kindness and say, look, you know what, the best I can do, if I want to help you out that way, this is what I can do. And all I can tell you is 90% of the time people often do things for me with my approach that is different. They even say afterwards, you know, I don't know, I would never have done that, but you seem so nice. And I think I'm not trying to manipulate them either, Jason. It's just genuinely thinking about, look, there's a person here with a situation. Let's see if I can help out. If I can make money, if I can solve their problem and end up with a property that serves me long term, then it's a win-win for everyone, right?
Yeah, it sure is. As we wrap up here, I want to ask you one question, David. Do you have any experience doing lease options or rent-to-own deals on any of your properties? I know that you're a buy and holder, as am I, but the fact is the people who do those strategies with their tenants, tenants tend not to exercise the option by and large. And, you know, it's a good way to get the tenant to take better care of the property, maybe increase cash flow sometimes. I just wanted to ask you if you do that at all.
I haven't personally, but I understand. I have friends who do that a lot. It's kind of a primary way. And I think you're right. There's three or four things that can happen. I think there's the upside and the downside. The upside is you end up with, like you say, it's a stronger cash flow. And you end up with somebody who's starting to think like they own it. And of course, the only negative is if it goes sideways, which again, you know, whether you ask them to leave after you have their money out of it. That's the only part with that it can be hard on people. But I think that primarily, if again, remember, you know, an entrepreneur is someone who solves people's problems for a profit. And if you can help someone get into a property and that you can do it whatever way you can do it, right? So if you're the landlord and you do a rent to own, and you help them that way, and at the end of it you make a much bigger profit because of it, and you've helped them do something they couldn't do without you, I'm all for it. It's just not my thing. I don't do it.
Yeah, right. Good stuff. Hey, give out your website.
Yeah, it's amplifiedliving.com, amplifiedliving.com. And the show, I do a show called The Crank It Up Show on iTunes. So if you want to jump in there as well, Jason and I will be on there a lot together, I can tell. Jason, thanks. You were awesome.
Hey, thank you so much, David. Appreciate having you on the show, and happy investing to you and, of course, our listeners.
You know, sometimes I think of Jason Hartman as a walking encyclopedia on the subject of creating wealth.
Well, you're probably not far off from the truth, Penny, because Jason actually has a 3-book set on creating wealth that comes with 60 digital download audios.
Yes, Jason has that unique ability to make you understand investing the way it should be. It's a world where anything less than 26% annual return is disappointing.
I love how he actually shows us how we can be excited about these scary times and exploit the incredible opportunities this present economy has afforded us.
We can pick local markets untouched by the economic downturn, exploit packaged commodities investing, and achieve exceptional returns safely and securely.
I also like how he teaches you to protect the equity in your home before it disappears and how to outsource your debt obligations to the government.
And the entire set of advanced strategies for wealth creation is being offered at a savings of $94.
That's right. And to get your Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series, complete with over 60 hours of audio and three books, just go to jasonhartman.com/store.
If you want to be able to sit back and collect checks every month, just like a banker, Jason's Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series is for you. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc. exclusively.